to I'm From the Internet, a podcast about somethingawful.com, the goons, and their consequences. I'm Chicago illustrator Winslow Demain, and I'm sitting here with Jay Brandstetter, an internet historian. Jay, how have you been?
The past couple of days, like, for my particular, like, circle as, like, an internet historian has just been fantastic for me because, just to date when we're recording this, it's March 17th, so this is the week that the Nazi cartoonist Stone Toss, his identity got revealed. And it turns out that Fred met him once, and it was like, oh yeah, he was just like the worst fucking guy at the 8chan meeting. Like, even the other internet Nazis couldn't stand him because he couldn't just turn it off. And, like, I've just been like, it's so funny when someone turns out to be exactly who you thought they were going to be. Like, it's just very validating to be like, yeah, none of these people are happy. And, like, it's just very funny to me.
Yeah, it's like Nazism is like the final death spasms of a deeply unloved man. But it makes me, you know, with him getting, like, outed and everything, I mean, it's dope and cool and, like, absolutely, like, no problem with it, but it does make me wonder that he's already successful enough. Like, he's already making all of the money he could ever possibly want for being an internet Nazi. So it's not like that's going to show up if he's, like, applying for a job anywhere. I imagine that he's pretty secluded with his own group of, like, yes men friends who are all basically as bad as, or, worse than him. And so I just wonder, like, outside of feeling, you know, a little scared that everybody knows his name, I can't imagine much of anything at all happening to the guy, right?
Yeah, because, like, he did have a day job. I couldn't understand a sense of it. Like, I guess for me, the interesting thing is, like, it's not just it's the cover up. It's the fact that, like, he complained to Elon about it, and now, like, after, like, months and months of Elon Musk being like, you know, we can't have this one guy's name out there. It's okay for libs of TikTok to be, like, sicking people after middle schoolers, but now it's like this whole weird escalation. Like, a bunch of people have been. It's just so funny how stuff like this happens, where it's never just. And, like, if he had just also, much like with Brigador, he could have just, like, ignored this, but instead he did, like, he like acknowledged it basically. We're in the middle of it unfolding. So I'm, like you said, I'm curious to see how this all ends up, because this feels like an escalation of something that's been kind of, like, kicking around for a while. And I just don't know where it's going to end up.
Yeah. He had a day job.
Yeah. He was working. That's what the big thing was. He worked for a tech, like, a firm or something, like, and that's what people were surprised. It made people be like, because, you know, it's also, like, a lot of the stuff he said wasn't true. Like, he described himself, like, I'm not going to dig how he looks, but, like, all the stuff he said, all the stuff wasn't true. So all of a sudden, it's like, maybe he wasn't telling the truth about being an idiot. Like, he lied about everything else. Maybe he isn't actually a super wealthy person or whatever. And if he does have, like, a day job, and also, like there was a big thing about him, like, getting his stuff removed, like, from his, like, it's just, like I said, it's all unfolding. So there's going to be some real, it's probably, like, a really interesting documentary about this, like, a year or two from now.
There's no way he could have a Patreon, right? Because Patreons generally go after Nazi stuff.
I don't know.
This is all stuff that we could look up.
Yeah, I don't actually know. I know for a while there was a thing called Hatreon. Like, no joke, literally called Hatreon. It was Patreon for hate creators. Like,
oh, man. Wow. My hate pop won't ever stop. Yeah, that's so fucking wild.
I mean, I guess you have to commit to the bit, I guess.
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah, it's so that's curious, because I he's, like, one of the big names, and, like, you know, I just think that if you have any degree of, like, a following, like, I make a living off of my art, and I have, like, 10,000 followers on Instagram, right? Yeah. And that guy had millions. And so, like, either he's, like, completely lacking in any kind of business acumen, but he's, like, not managed to instigate or, like, to capitalize on his followership, because you don't need a day job if you have his kind of follow.
Yeah.
You know? So, but then again, now that I say that out loud, the trouble with his stuff is that, like, it is an inherently very toxic brand. And so, you know, obviously his whole thing is anonymity. So it's not like he's going to be selling shirts and stickers and stuff like that, because, like, all the whole thing about Nazis these days is just, like, how, like, tee-hee private they are, which is so funny to me. Because, like, this, you know, like, long story short, it would be very hard to monetize his followership, because you do, they're, what do you sell them other than other monikers of hatred? He's anonymous for a reason, right? So I don't, unless you are like, you know, the kind of guy who wears those fucking hentai hoodies, you're probably not going to be wearing like a Stone Toss shirt, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, that's one thing that I think is so funny, because like I made that TikTok making fun of how many swastikas and Nazi designs I see at tattoo conventions, and like one guy called me like, "You're such a pretty little cuck boy," and I looked at his account. No videos, no retweets, no follows. Everything's private, right? And I was just like, say it with your fucking chest, man.
Yeah.
I thought the whole thing about, like, the Nazis is being, like, chest-thumping, proud Aryan men. And then I'm like, you know, say it with your chest. If you're, like, if you're the superior race, say it. Come on. Stand up. Don't, like, cower in the shadows like a little fucking baby.
Yeah, like seeing the, you know? Like, seeing the reactions, like, this might take a little bit of stuff. But have you ever seen the Spike Lee movie Black Klansman from a few years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's a really good, for people who haven't seen it, there's a really good scene in that movie where it's like these two conversations cut together, where one is like a group of black people listening to like a survivor of a lynching recall what it was like, and the other is a bunch of racist white people sitting around watching Triumph of the Will and talking about the stuff in it as if it was real. And like, when I see the way that people talk about doxing in the wake of this, it's like the people who are like normally like people, it's like on one hand you have like the people who do this, it's like trans, like for them it's like these are people who have actually like people who actually get killed when they're doxxed. When a trans person gets doxxed, it's an invitation for violence. When a Nazi gets doxxed, it's letting people know don't work with this person. And seeing people talk about the same action in completely different contexts, well, one person is actually a victim, the other side is like trying to act as if they are the ones being victimized in the same way. It just gave me very strong flashbacks to that one scene from that movie.
I mean, I know that this is going to be infuriating to a certain subgroup of dickheads on the internet, but my thing with, like, doxing and all of that shit is, like, for some fucking reason, people have tricked themselves into thinking that, like, absolutely everything needs to be fair, that, like, oh, a Nazi punching down on somebody for being trans, that's bad, but we should never punch the Nazi. That's because we'll be just as bad as them. My thing about doxing is like, it sucks and it's terrible. Of course I want it to happen to my enemies. Why wouldn't I? You know what I mean? Like that, it's so silly to have the idea that we should withhold, you know, all of this, private stuff because like, God forbid we hurt our own enemies. You know, like, we're going to be, like, all prim and proper and collected as, you know, these people run roughshod over the entire fucking globe. And, like, fuck them.
Yeah,
exactly. I want bad things to happen to my enemies and good things to happen to my friends. That's not an insane political opinion.
Not at all.
Like, that's... You know,
I gotta say, that's one of the things I love about
fuck
my job.
Hans Christian Graebner of Spring, Texas.
Yes. Big Hans, a large man named Hans.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the perks of this job is knowing that, like, I can't get fired for anything I say in this job because if anyone, like, complains to Fred about it, you just gonna, like, send him fat raccoons.
Yeah, you do work for the epicenter of a lot of things. Yeah. So, yeah, I imagine your resume could be pretty much anything. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, man. Other than that, I don't know when this is going to drop. We have like so many episodes backlogged.
Yeah.
I have been making I should be working on the card game, and I am a lot. It's just like it's at a level of informational density that just hurts my fucking brain. But I've been making silicone molds of these old dental molds that I have, and I'm making like dozens of plaster casts of teeth for some reason.
Yeah,
and now I'm making the plaster casts of the rat hole that I'm gonna give to people who donate to the Chicago Women's Shelter. So that's what I've up to all day. That and card game stuff. So
that's fantastic. No, molding is very fun. When he's posted the pictures of it, it's just like a desk covered in teeth.
Yeah. It is a lot of teeth. Also, I am now in my closet to record this, so if the sound is better, that's why. It's a pain in the ass, but here we are. So, what do you have for me today?
Hey, well, thankfully, today's going to be a lighter one than the intro there. So, since you are working on a Kickstarter today, I do have something that is appropriately Kickstarter-related. I think we're going to do our first big Kickstarter fiasco, which is fucked. Earlier, you joked about how we were kind of doing the hits, because we were, like, for podcasting, because we've been doing true crime stuff, and it's like, now we're doing Kickstarter failures. We're doing all the genres next. Like, so.
Oh, but that's my favorite, you know?
Yeah, and I do have like a fun connection to this because I'm the OP of the original awful Kickstarters thread on Something Awful. When I do the episode on Doobie's Doghouse, I'll talk more in depth about that because I am like there is like I am the small domino leading up to a big Something Awful thing, which is very funny. But this is about a much bigger and more successful Kickstarter that has actually crossed over into like mainstream like coverage as it was being done. They were talking about a little game called Barkley 2. Have you ever heard of that before this?
No.
I'm glad because this is a very interesting example of like how crowdfunding like really changed stuff, how things that are niche can, it's a whole fun story, but this is something that I've been a part of basically from the whole beginning. I played this game when it came out. I followed the whole thing. So anyways, I guess I'll just start from the top here. Like, one of my favorite things about internet history is how you'll have a bunch of different content that you like independently. And then later you'll find out that they're all made by the same guy. Like, for example, if you're in the target audience of this show, you might be familiar with a crude animation of Dilbert going on a workplace shooting set to chiptunes titled Dilbert 3. And
this is very funny because it is it's an MS Paint illustration of Dilbert pointing a gun at you, but it's like done up. So it's like, I guess, I don't know, 50% more realistic. It's still very cartoony and like clumsy and stuff, but like, you know, very two dimensional everything. But it is just kind of like a much more jacked Dilbert pointing a Glock at you. Glock, I don't know, a fucking handgun.
Yeah.
I know more about automatics than I know about handguns. That's my thing.
Yeah, it's sort of, this was like really big when it came out. I know, which came first, Ranch or Cool Ranch? And the phrase like dehumanize yourself and face to bloodshed, that's actually from like an 80s Japanese computer game, but this popularized it. Like that pops up in all sorts of places. Like I remember when Trump won the election in 2016 on Chapo Trap House, one of the people said dehumanize yourself and face to bloodshed. That's why I was like, oh wow, wait, this game really went places. But yeah.
That's funny. Yeah, somebody was being a wise ass at me on Twitter earlier today, and I looked at their account, and one of the more recent things that they had posted was about All Your Base or Belong to Us. I'm just like, oh god, I can't believe we're still doing this.
Yeah, no, people unstuck in time like that is so funny. Like on Something Awful, I was checking their like online critics thread, and someone there's some people are still like complaining about Borderlands 2, and I'm like, that game came out in the first Obama administration. Like that game is so old.
Really?
Yeah, it came out in 2012.
God, it did.
Yeah, it's like
that's so funny. I remember being so fucking stoked to play that because I played the living shit out of Borderlands 1, and it came out when I was with my college girlfriend, who I don't hate this person, but like, oh boy, if I had known what I was getting into, I don't hate her at all. And I wish her all the best. She's extremely smart, and there's a lot of good things about her, but there's definitely a part where it's like, man, I am addicted to being cheated on.
Nice preview for the steroid episode.
What's up?
That's a nice preview for this for the episode I'm writing now about steroids, because man, a lot of infidelity in that one.
Oh yeah, well that makes sense. And don't get me wrong, like I was not a great man either, but but I just remember Borderlands 2 coming out, and she didn't like know anything about it, but she was like, you know, excited that I was excited, and I played it, and I just remember her like kind of watching the smile fade from my face, and I was just like, oh, it goes from like, oh, hey, I had a piece of candy, to like, I'm eating bowls of nerds and runts for breakfast kind of feeling, where like,
it's like if Willy Wonka was doing Saw and you were like in a trap, where you had to eat your way out of candy to keep from dying. It's like playing that. You were just drowning in candy.
There, like, not a single fragment of that entire game was funny in any capacity. It's so annoying. And like, it, you know, it's the thing where like, when the word Riz first bubbled up to white Twitter and people are like, oh God, so nobody tell the people at Borderlands because they're going to have a mission called like, go Riz the Queen or some bullshit. God, I know we're getting way off track right away, but have you seen the trailer for the Borderlands movie?
No, I'm very like, I played like a couple hours of Borderlands 1. I was like, no, I'm good. So I've been able to observe all this safely from a distance.
Borderlands 1 is really fun and really good. And like, it's amazing that like such an insane bubbling up with content kind of game ended up being not like that's the more tolerable of the Borderlands game. But the Borderlands movie is coming out and like, I tweeted about it, but I'm like, I can't think of a way that it could be worse. it's the most annoying possible dialogue from like Kevin Hart.
Okay.
It just looks extremely like something that like a kid trapped in 2004 would think is like totally badass. It's like, oh God, this doesn't look good.
I will there is one Borderlands joke I will shout out that is like incredibly funny. And the adventure game that Telltale did, there's like a thing where throughout it you can collect money, and if you hold on to all the money you can possibly get at the end of the game, there's like a thing where you're hiring mercenaries, and there's like this top secret mercenary you can only afford if you saved up all your money, and your reward for doing all that and doing that is it's fucking Claptrap, the most annoying character in the game, after they like conspicuously had him not in there because like, everyone was annoyed by him. So it's like this huge troll on the player, like, oh, your reward for saving up all this money is the most annoying character in the game is hanging out with you on the final thing. I was like, you know what? You got me. There was no Claptrap in this game, so using it like this, that got me. That was funny. Like, I kind of like that. That was almost like a near joke.
Yeah, I do appreciate when a joke requires a lot of withholding. Like, it takes a long burn to get to a joke. Like, I can like that, but then again, that wasn't made by Gearbox. That was made by Telltale.
Yeah, it's like my favorite Telltale game. It's legitimately very funny. Like, it's the only one I've replayed.
Oh. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't like the early Telltale, or I didn't mind the early Telltale stuff. I mean, especially The Walking Dead was really good. But anyways, let's get back to whatever I'm looking at here.
So Dilbert 3 was made by a musician, animator, writer, and game developer named Eric Shoemaker, who went by the name Chef Boyardee online and specifically on the Something Awful forums. I have his profile here pulled up, registered in 2007 and negative 63 posts. So, you know,
a lot of Fyad.
Yeah, Fyad poster. Yeah, he was a Fyad poster, and he had a very honed comedic voice. I know that like comparing Fyad posters to Drill is kind of tired, but he really did have a very Drill like tone and level of like surreal boundary pushing. I'm skipping over his early posting because it's not super accessible, and that's not what the saga is about. But he's someone who is funny. Like, I will vouch for him. And what makes him noteworthy in this story is the fact that he was a game developer specifically. He founded this studio here. Tales of Games. Yeah, if you would explain the jokes there.
So funny. The logo is like the crossed what are those, olive branches? Not olive branches.
Yeah, like
it's the wreath, like
the palm d'or.
Like
for
when you win an award and you put like the two plant sticks together. Jesus Christ, I sound so fucking stupid. But yeah, it's the little those, and then it's just like a little 8-bit T-O-G in the middle, but the name of the company is Tales of Games, but Games has an apostrophe, which is like so funny to me.
Yeah, and their logo also has like, there's like a red underline under the T-O-G, like on Microsoft Word, like this isn't a word.
That's so fucking funny.
yeah,
you can see, I didn't
their
notice.
Logo
I
is making tell. Us crack up. Like these guys are funny, and
yeah.
They didn't release a lot of games, but the ones they did were all kind of like this. Like, they would just, like, be making a roguelike and be like, okay, what if it was Wu-Tang Clan themed? So that's how you'd get the Sewer Goblet, which was one of their games, where it's literally like, you're instead of like the traditional class, like Rogue, Warrior, it's like you can be Method Man or like whoever else in there. And then you go down, and it's like a regular...
Well, scroll back up real quick.
Go back up there.
Because I'm looking at the sprites for the Wu-Tang characters are actually pretty good. They're like, you know, big head sprite, little body kind of thing. So they're very expressive.
16-bit RPG kind of,
16-bit RPG. So we have Method Man here. Strength, 8. Intelligence, 16. Dexterity, 14. HP, 24. Hunger, 390. Starting gear, Glock, 30 bullets. Chicken leg, spells. Abilities, science. Method Man's full name is Scientific Method Man and Wu-Tang's official group scientist. He has harnessed the power of science and is capable of using it for destructive and supportive purposes. All of that's funny, minus the chicken leg.
Yeah, I visibly winced. I was like,
God,
oh, I forgot.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I'm glad that you said that, because, like, this isn't going to be a secret racism episode. In fact, kind of pretty much the opposite. But it is worth mentioning that Chef Boyardee is a white dude, as is Brian Round.
Oh, like, not just a white dude, almost like blue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know when white guys are...
he's translucent.
Like they almost turn semi-translucent, right?
He's like so white, another white dude can wear him to be a ghost for Halloween.
Yeah, that's so funny.
And there's the rest of the team that they get together. And yeah, I'm only bringing this up now because I'm going to talk a lot of sugar about the representation in Barkley. And I want to make it very clear that's kind of a death of the author thing. I was around then. Like, this was a game that got posted in YCS and was really popular. And like, and there, this is a bunch of white dudes doing ironic references to black culture for an audience of other white dudes. There is a bit of ironic transgressiveness to there that, like, out of context, you can't really pick up on. And especially later when you're trying to present it, like, I want to be like that. That was kind of an element of that. That's not a joke. And
yeah, because like, okay, there was a thing on Twitter recently about making a point about like the era of like ironic rap songs made by white people where the joke is that they are not good at rapping, which was like, Jesus Christ, that was so much a thing. That was like early 2000s into like the mid, like, I don't know, 2010s. They were still doing it. But like, what's the show with like the hip hopotamus and the rhinoceros or whatever? Whatever his name is, I can't remember, but you know what I'm talking about. You're screaming at the phone, all one of our listeners. but that was very much a thing where it's like, there are white people in rap that are doing it with heart and love and respect. And like, they're not annoying, pointing at themselves. Like, isn't it funny that a white guy is doing this?
Yeah. Check it out. I'm doing an acapella cover of rap, but I'm replacing the N-word with ninja. Eh?
Oh boy, yeah.
That's my one joke.
Yeah. And so it's just very funny to see, like, y'all remember Scroobius Pip?
Oh god, yes.
Do you remember that dude? Oh yeah. That was a thing where like every once in a while, a white rapper will like pop up and I'll listen to it. And I'll go, huh, okay. And then like 30 seconds later, I'll go, oh, wait, no.
Yeah, I'm kind of like,
the one bit of respect I will say to Scroobius Pip is that when Pitchfork was dying or like was being killed by the CEO, he posted a screenshot of their review of his album, which was one of the rare Pitchfork 0.0s. Just like, they were just, they're like, not a moment of this piece of shit is fucking redeemable. It is garbage all the way through. And you know, it is. It's like sad boy hipster white rap. There's not a lot you can pull from it.
Yes, I guess kind of like.
But he did post a clip of it saying, like, you know, we need Pitchfork because they are genuinely are a big part of the music industry, even though they fucking hate me. And I was like, all right, man, you know what? Touche. I would have a hard time highlighting people who fucking despise me.
How do you think I feel?
And I'm nobody. Yeah. Why do you think I'm in my dark little closet? Yeah. I just want all of the people who hate me and think that I am like a cringe lord, sad fuck. You are all correct. I just want you to stop. That's all I want to say. I just want you to leave me alone.
Yeah, it's just so exhausting. It's like it's like the human version of having to hit no on the donation every time you check out. It's like, I've already been through this. Jesus.
Yeah, dude, that's
is so there a funny checkbox I could do to opt out of this in the future?
like I just want you to know, I feel bad enough as it is. Y'all what? Broken nose from blows, ruin your rep when I pounce on my foes. Suppose I swing an epic just okay, so group of honkies are making
ironic
things of black culture,
and their games are mostly like game jam stuff. It doesn't go, but they finally see success in 2008 with their freeware role playing game Tales of Game Studios presents Chef Boyardee's Barkley Shut Up and Jam Gaiden, Chapter 1 of the Hoops Barkley Saga. And, like, every second word in there is, like, a multi-layered joke, so I can't break down the title, but it's simply just this density of jokes. So I'll just go down to the title screen.
Hang on. We need to do a yes, yes, no. Oh. You know yes, yes, no?
Yes. Yes. Okay, fine. We'll do a yes, yes, no. Okay.
So let's scroll down. So Barkley. So we have Barkley, the basketball player, right?
Yeah.
Shut Up and Jam is another basketball game. Am I right?
Yes, this was interesting. It was a Super Nintendo brawler, like a beat-em-up, like a side-scroller, but the premise was you played as Charles Barkley, and he used, like, basketball moves to beat people up.
That's real?
That's a real game. Barkley Shut Up and Jam was the Super Nintendo game that was a beat-em-up where you played as Charles Barkley. And recently, extra funny bit, they re-released it recently. A company has the rights to it, but they don't have the license for Charles Barkley anymore. So they literally, like, went onto Shutterstock, typed in, like, angry black man, and pulled up the first face that came up and just pasted over Charles Barkley. So everything is just a stock photo of a guy. Like, it's just so funny seeing how, like, out of place it looks.
And, okay, so Barkley Shut Up and Jam is an existing game.
For the Super Nintendo.
Gaiden is probably a reference to Ninja Gaiden, which is another, like, stealth action game, I think. I don't know.
It's a little broader than...
I imagine...
It's a little broader than that. Gaiden is, like, the Japanese word. It's, like, a Japanese word. I don't know the exact word. Fred isn't here right now, so I can't get the translation. But in general, like, a Gaiden is sort of, like, an Elseworlds or, like, a new story. Like Majora's Mask is considered, like, a Gaiden game of Ocarina of Time. Like, it's not an official sequel. It's reusing a lot of characters. But you can tell it's, like, shares a lot of the same DNA. That's a Gaiden game. Or, like...
So, like... Yeah. Elden Ring would be a Gaiden of Dark Souls.
Yeah, I think, like, Rebirth would be, like, the literal translation. So it's, like... it's a very popular subtitle in anime.
Interesting.
Like the way that when we reboot stuff, we do like reboot or the thing or rebirth. It's Gaiden is like the Japanese word they would use.
Revolutions.
Yeah, revolutions. Yeah. Exactly.
So, because my first thought was that it was an oblique reference to Ninja Gaiden, ninja being a sub word for the N word, right?
Oh, thankfully,
Gaiden makes more sense now.
Yeah. Thankfully, no.
Chapter one of the Hoops Barkley Saga, which, you know, that's all Hoops with a Z, whatever. Barkley, obvious. And then Saga, the only kink in this one is that the G is capitalized as well.
Yeah, it's Saga, capital S, capital G, all lowercase A's. That's a reference to a very obscure role-playing game series called the Saga series. So this is also, it's tying it into, like, a very obscure Japanese role-playing game series with that.
Oh, okay.
And also, just as the added...
Yeah, and the... Go ahead.
And as an added bonus, the fact that the full title is Chef Boyardee is like, that's the guy's name, but because that name is also a brand, that's a very funny joke. It's like it's being presented by the canned food company.
Yeah. The image for this, or like the thing that it's
this is the title screen of the game. Back. Yeah. Is it originally?
Yes. It's Barkley looking back at you. It's like a photograph that has been like rendered down to like 16-bit. Depth, and it's him standing in what appears like it just looks like a desolate road in a city that It kind of gives you like Chernobyl Fallout vibes, but it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of destruction. Oh, that might actually be Kripien.
It has the Ferris wheel in the background. I think this is a stalker.
It has the Yeah. So depending on when it came out, that could be a stalker reference, and it has like a really intensely dramatic sky sweeping over the top there. So yeah, it's you know, you got a basketball player in like an extremely dark and hostile environment, which is, you know, is itself pretty funny.
Yeah, and also I'll call out, because I'm gonna talk more about Barkley's characterization later, but he's looking at, he's not like making a wacky face, he's kind of looking back with an intense look, like here we go again, kind of like that's one of the things that rules about Barkley as a character. I'll say is they play, he plays everything very straight. He's a straight man, and that's how a lot of the comedy works. So, like, this really captures the vibe very well of just this like very straight man, professional athlete walking into like the post cyberpocalypse. And then once it blew up, he got an artist actually did this like bespoke artwork for the game. So this is what the updated title screen looks like, where it's sort of like a Final Fantasy style, like epic depiction of all the characters.
I'm gonna be honest, at first glance at this, it took me a lot to figure out what I was looking at. I could tell, it's like, you remember that picture of, it's like a picture where there's like no discernible objects.
One of those
like
weird AI things, yeah.
Yeah, that one, that one was one of my favorite things where I was like, where did this come from and why is this like, this is like a Lovecraftian, you know, JPEG. But yeah, no, okay, so this one looks very much like a Final Fantasy or like a multi-face poster where you have like all these different magical people and then like, see, this is where we get into there's nothing in this yet that is like racist. Right. There was the chicken leg earlier, which is like there is a universe where Method Man makes references to chicken legs in his rap. I don't know if that is a reference to like a thing that he did. Maybe that's their out for that. But it also is probably just like, you know, an edgelord joke. But we have like a character on this screen here with it's like a black teenager who's wearing a basketball jersey with a number 3 on it, but he has like an enormous flat top that is like, if you can imagine, like 2 coffee cans,
like if you took the like Cat in the Hat,
half a Marge,
yeah,
Marge Simpson, half a Marge, or like a brown Cat in the Hat, you put it on it. And so it's one of those things where it's like, it's not necessarily racist, but it is, hyper exaggerating stereotypical features. So we're not there yet. Also, for the record, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. So, you know, don't think that I'm speaking on behalf of anybody here.
Yeah, like this whole time we haven't mentioned one of these people has a basketball for skin. There's plot reasons for that. I'll
explain it. I couldn't even tell. I thought it was just like a fucked up looking guy.
Yeah, but obviously because of all that discussion off the title, you said I'm just going to be shortening it to Barkley going forward. So whenever I say Barkley or Barkley 1, I'm referring to this game. And after all that build up, I actually have the trailer for the game here. It's 2 minutes or so.
Okay. That kind of rules. Okay. There's a lot to say about how much I love that. One of the things is just that it starts with the NVIDIA, like NVIDIA, which I haven't heard that in how many years.
And it's even better because that's how the game itself starts. You load up this RPG Maker game and then it uses like the high quality like thing that like AAA games start with, and immediately it's just like,
yeah. Yeah, for people who aren't aware, like, I mean, if NVIDIA is a graphics card manufacturer, and they would have their own proprietary things, like if they made their own like firmware or like, you know, editing software, they people would use it to make higher end games that look really pretty and really nice, and they would put the like a little NVIDIA thing when you boot up the game, kind of like the title cards on a movie where you can see like, you know, all the different production companies at the start there. And this is not one of those games. I don't think that you could probably run this on a graphing calculator. So that alone is very funny. It's like having the THX surround sound when you're just like listening to like a JPEG or listening to an MP3 of fart sounds. and just the fact that it starts with Tales of Games with the apostrophe is very funny to me. You're right. This is very drill of being like very stone-faced and weird and disjointed. But it looks like, you know, a Final Fantasy RPG where it's all just basketball themed. And it I will be honest, I just kind of clipped through it to save time for the pod, but it looks really fucking funny because of how hard they go. You know, I love it when a motherfucker hauls ass, you know?
Yeah, I have some of the writing here. I'm going to talk more about the game in depth. But yeah, I'm not going to talk a ton about it as a game or as comedy because, in my opinion, it's a funny game and you can beat it in an afternoon and it plays pretty well. It's not very hard. So my recommendation is, like, if you're interested, play it or watch a Let's Play. Like, even if you aren't in the pocket for a satire of, like, a 2000s RPG Maker game, it has this really good surreal sense of humor to it and that strong voice. Like, a lot of Charles Barkley's one-liners are drill tweets, basically, and I've included a couple of my favorites here. I'm going to read them. First one is, I believe ghosts are like dogs and they just sort of do things arbitrarily. Like, whenever someone talks about like a ghost doing something weird, I just think about that. Like, oh yeah, they are like dogs.
And yeah, that's funny.
And another one here. This is, I could see you're no greenhorn when it comes to pre 21st century b-ball vernacular and colloquialisms. Like,
I do love the juxtaposition of like all of these different types of language, I think is really funny. Like, who's ever used the word greenhorn, you know?
Yeah, and like also abbreviating basketball as b-ball when you're using words like vernacular and colloquialism. Just
that's so funny. It does make me think of Conan O'Brien's writing for The Simpsons and like how much his writing shaped the Monty Burns character, because if you look through the rest of Conan's writing and all of the other like his favorite jokes and characters that they do, they're all like 1900s characters who talk like cartoon villains. You know, you can see that.
Yeah, they make all these super oblique references to like culture.
Yeah, and Osmo Car and the Zeppelin tube and like all of that.
Ahoy hoy! Yeah.
Ahoy hoy! Yeah.
Yeah. I guess just to provide some more context for this game, I replayed Barkley during quarantine with a Tumblr person who had never played it before, and I was astounded at how not racist it was, because every other time I go back to this period to the internet to try to show them something, it was always way more racist than I remember. Like, a year before Barkley came out, you know, I was on YTMND, where the big gaming meme at the time was black people steal things. Like, if you were on YTMND, that was also that was originally a Something Awful Photoshop that someone stole and put on YTMND, and that's how it became a meme. So again, I just did made a little episode within episode. That's where that's another thing Something Awful created, the racist punch out meme. But when I replayed Barkley, I was always expecting some horrible racist joke I'd forgotten to pop up, and it never happened. Like, There's early on in the game, there's like an Asian shopkeeper who transcribes his L's and R's, which sucks. And the currency in the game is Neo Shekels, which is like supposed to be a joke how like in cyberpunk games, they'll have like futuristic currencies. But, you know, now shekel has a much worse connotation. Even at the time, that was kind of like the transgressiveness of it, even if it wasn't like, you know, the part that's aged the worst is the fact that you fight Bill Cosby's ghost dad as a boss at one point.
Oh, yeah. I feel like if you did Neo Wampum, it would be a different thing, because I don't think anybody talks about Wampum anymore.
Yeah. Okay, I guess, so what's your favorite fictional video game currency, if you have one?
I mean, I'm trying to think, because like the only... Jesus Christ, that is the most 32-year-old man recording a podcast in his closet question. I guess like Tiberium was always like a fun idea for me, like the crystals that are like super toxic but you need them for everything. I don't know, I mean, just like, I just thought that was cool. I don't know, are there other more interesting currencies.
I think my favorite is Zenny from Mega Man, just because like it has like its own. They made like a little Z symbol for it, like the Y for the Zen. I mean, for the yen in Japan. I always thought that was cute. Like, I don't know. This is like a gamer nerd thing. I feel like knowing all the different weird types of currencies games come up with. And that's kind of
the space like Dark Souls has souls. Yeah, I'm trying to think anything else. I'll think of something later. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Inscription, you get like, it's not really currency, but it's bones.
The bones are very good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the bones are their money.
Yeah. Sparkly is legit one of the only games of this type I could think of from the 2000s that has a black main character, a majority black cast, and depicts like a healthy, loving relationship between a single father and his son. Like, that's who Hoop Sparkly is. It's Charles Barkley's son, and he's been widowed, and he's raising him alone in the cyberpocalypse. And the whole thing is his son is like very naive, and he's trying to protect him from like the bleakness of their world. Like, the reason why I mention this is like, if you weren't into Japanese role-playing games like in the 90s and the early 2000s, one of the things that sucked about them was that there weren't many like people of color as characters. Like, I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and in high school I was friends with a lot of black nerds, and they were always like, I want to cosplay for this convention we're going to, but there's nobody who looks like me I can dress up as. The newest Final Fantasy game takes place in the Caribbean, and half the characters speak in a patois, and everyone's white. Like, it was a really, if you want,
yeah, that's the thing that like it so fucking bums me out, is like, one of the coolest things about working at Comic-Cons and C2E2 and all that shit is like that cosplay is for fucking everyone, and that for as much as like white Gamergate fucks sneer about like black characters in media or whatever, it is so fucking meaningful. It's like, yeah, I've seen so many black guys dress as Goku or whatever, and that's great, you know? But, like, it's so meaningful to have someone who, like, to feel, like, represented on the screen, you know?
Like, when I lived in Jacksonville, I lived in the hood, and, like, when Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse came out and Miles Morales came out, like, Miles Morales stuff was everywhere the entire rest of the time I lived there. Because, I was like, finally, like, a superhero looks like me. And that's what those kids were saying. I don't look like him, you know what I mean? But from their perspective. Yeah. But, and I was like, yeah, this is really cool. And it's a great movie on top of that.
Yeah, it's, like, it's just really good and fun and meaningful. And, like, it's different when it's, like very much a clearly, like, a cash-in from one group to the next, you know, they're just plugging in like, all right, let's put in a cool black teenager in this. What do cool black teenagers like? And it's just a bunch of white guys deciding like, you know, they like eating their vegetables and going to bed early, you know,
like in the 80s comic book world when every black superhero was sports themed.
Yeah. Oh boy. But like, yeah, like Miles Morales, those fucking Spider-Man movies are like great, interesting. And like, yeah, dude, if I had never seen another person on screen that looked remotely like me and I got Miles Morales, yeah, I'd be stoked out of my mind. So it's so meaningful. And I hate so much that people are like making it into this like white genocide narrative. You know what I mean?
Yeah, really. It does. And that, like I said, that's why, like, looking back at this, it really is like, yeah, Pete, there really wasn't that much represent. The fact that this joke game, even if it was just like jokey references to 90s sports, like, you know, especially in the world of internet gamer comedy, where things were pretty bad there. And it's just really, it's one of those things where it retroactively adds value to it. And I think it's interesting that this game has had like a pretty long tail. Like people like a decade younger than me, like on my Discord, like, oh, they're like, oh, Barkley is Kino. Like when I mentioned I was gonna be doing this episode, like it is a game that is very, yeah. Like people, it still is like known and remembered. It's like a underground funny internet thing. People are super. And because I'm me, I just have to shout out the furry jokes in it are actually pretty funny. Like, again, another thing about this, it's very interesting. I mean, unusual for the
time. I also have to say that I've seen so much shit about, like, Final Fantasy has been a part of the culture for a billion fucking years. And it's amazing that, like, I could probably close my eyes and tell you the general idea of the story of Star Wars. I have no fucking idea what Final Fantasy is about. Not a clue. It's completely unintelligible all the way through.
Yeah.
That's all.
No, I totally get this. It is utterly impenetrable. And that's one of the things I like about the game, Barclays, because, like, yeah, that is something that is like an inherently funny concept. These just like impenetrable science fiction worlds with all these rules you don't understand. Like, people you tell, like, oh, right. you don't know that you're supposed to allocate your experience points and you're supposed to upgrade your weapons? Like, no, I've never played these games before. This is, you know.
Yeah. Makes me think of, like, Perfect Hair Forever.
Oh, man, that was...
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was, like, such a very, like, a great outsider's perspective on anime, which is just, like, oh, this is all just unintelligible to someone who, like, didn't go to anime club in high school, you know?
And I guess for Barclay, like, because Barclay was a freeware downloadable game, it's hard for me to get, like, a real concrete measure of how many people played it. But to give you an idea of, like, how far it penetrated gamer culture, like, GameSpot interviewed the creators. Hardcore Gaming 101, which is a real history, like, a real-ass site, did an article about it. And they usually do only, like, commercial games. They don't do freeware stuff that much. And in 2014, it was one of the featured games in the awful block of Games Done Quick, which, if you know anything about gaming culture, that's pretty big.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. So this came out in 20... When did this come out?
This came out in 2008. And then, like, it was big.
Okay.
And then, like, it was, like, they put the... and then it was on Something Awful, and then it kind of, like, spread and grew. And then, so by the time... This is all around the time of the sequel, because by this point, people are like, oh, yeah, this is that game I like. I have an excuse to write about it. So you had all this kind of people who are writing about it. And also, this was kind of when they were trying to promote the Kickstarter as well. They were doing the press circuit. Also, I have to shout out the picture from...
So, was this released on Steam? How is this released?
It was just an executable you downloaded off of their website. It was an RPG Maker game.
Oh, fascinating.
Well, not an RPG Maker. Okay. It was. Yeah, we'll talk more about that later. But yeah, it was literally just you downloaded off their website. This is entirely just like... And also, because it was a freeware game, like, someone could be like, yo, I uploaded it to Mega Upload. Check it out or whatever. Like, it just spread. That's one of the interesting things about, like, RPG Maker fandom and stuff like that, is how there's these little games like this that can just kind of blow up over, like, Yume Nikki or whatever. It's a really interesting world, and I'm not really a part of it, but I appreciate that it exists.
Yeah, you know, like, I hope that it you know, I've never played a good RPG Maker game, but I do know that, like, a lot of people are gonna like, mess around with those tools and get an idea for it, and then bump into some walls and go, oh, I wish I could do this differently, and then they're gonna find another way to do it, and eventually they're gonna do something really good, you know? Like, nobody starts off with a $100,000 camera. They start off with a little piece of shit, and then eventually they become a cinematographer.
Yeah, you know? And with RPG Maker, especially...
Every single person that has a camera becomes a cinematographer, is what I'm saying.
Eventually, yeah. It is interesting, like, the average person knows so much about cinematography and, like, photography compared to, like, a couple generations ago. Like, I mean, it was, like,
surreal. I was being a little stinker, but yeah, I guess,
like, I
guess people do know a lot more than they used,
like,
to.
Like, I watched, like, an early 90s, like, Roger Ebert thing once. It was him explaining to people, like, about pan and scan and widescreen, like, talking about how subtitles worked and what they were. And I was like, knowledge is weird like that.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of stuff from Something Awful itself about the game that's proper, that I can talk about here, that's super interesting. This was mostly table setting for the actual topic of this episode, which is the sequel to Barclay 2, the full title here. I'll read it for you. The Magical Realm of Tir-na-Nog, Escape from Necron 7, Revenge of Cucullin, the official game of the movie, Chapter 2 of the Hoops Barclay Saga.
Jesus Christ. Aqua Teen Hunger Force, : movie film for theaters, : the official soundtrack.
Yeah, really, really adding on to the joke of the first game. I guess just to set the stage for where this part is. So it's 2012. It's 4 years since Barclay came out. Eric Shoemaker and Brian Realm are finishing college and are mostly just doing little game jam things, but they want to try and break into game dev as a career. And 2012 is when Kickstarter started blowing up in the gaming world, and you had projects like Broken Age and Mighty No. 9 letting game developers who had fan bases but no funding get their fans to pay for game development. So, so on November 28th of 2012, Chef Boyardee posts a thread in games. And I was thinking, the way I have this set up here is I post his pitch, and then I'll have a commentary bullet. So do you want to read Chef Boyardee, and then I do the commentary? Or should I read it all? Because it is long.
Yeah, sure. Is it the I am C. Boyardee Shoemaker?
Yeah, Mystical Greetings starts from there. Yeah.
Okay. Mystical greetings, fellow goons and she-goons.
I am Eric C. Boyardee Shoemaker, one of the lead idiots behind Tales of Games Studios, an independent VidCon developer whose members have worked on games like Station 37, Sewer Goblet, and the winner of the 2011 Essay Game Dev Contest, Mountain of Debt. And of course, the 2008 Edutainment Tour de Force, Barkley, Shut Up and Jam, Gaiden. We are really excited to announce that we are going to be working on the sequel to Barkley Gaiden, called The Magical Realm of Tir Nagog, Escape from Necron 7, The Revenge of Cuchulainn, the official game of the movie, Chapter 2 of the Hoops Barkley Saga. And we've launched the Kickstarter for it. We want to make this game something that is not only funnier, but more fun than the original. What is Barkley 2? Take my hand and come with me on an edutaining journey. Barkley 2 is the direct sequel to Barkley 1. It picks up where the original story left off. It tells the tale of X114 Jam 7, an amnesiac baller, searching for his identity amidst the post-cyberpocalyptic ruins of Necron 7, the ancient space ziggurat ruled by the malevolent AI Cuchulainn, sworn enemy of all ballers. Forced into fugitivity, X114 Jam 9 sets off in search of the Cyber Dwarf, an enigmatic slam scholar and the only one capable of revealing the truth behind his mysterious past and brilliant b-ball destiny.
So yeah, that's...
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is there a reference to Cuchulainn?
Not in the first game.
That I'm missing?
Is
that just like a series of letters to make something sound cool?
I looked up, apparently it's from Celtic mythology, same with Tir Nanog. Like,
that's what I figured, yeah.
Like, that's one of...
Oh, okay, like, yeah, that makes
they
sense.
They do kind of, like, in the first one, there's a war between genies and Draegar, so, like, they kind of pull from, like, weird, like, mythology stuff, so in this one they got really into Celtic mythology, I think. Yeah, that's why I had to look up how to pronounce that.
That's fucking fascinating,
yeah, Celtic
man.
Mythology on a space prison planet.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I love, like, Slavic lore and stuff like that, and I really want more games. Like, if you're going to take inspiration from old stories, I just love it when people are taking inspiration from, like less explored parts of the world. Like, one thing that I thought was really interesting... when I was in the sewers under Kyiv... In Ukraine, this is before the war, there was this, like, hardened mass on the wall of the sewer, and it was, like, some sort of, like, fungal deposit, and the guy that I was with said that this is called he said it's called a stone flower, and stone flowers... it's something to do with a Slavic or Ukrainian folklore story that goes back, you know, hundreds of years. And stone flowers are an artifact that you can find in Stalker,
ooh,
which is set, obviously, in Chernobyl. And so I just really liked that there was a cross reference there. I don't know. We've heard a lot of the... Western lore, and so I'm always interested in, you know, the Celtic or the...
Yeah, like when that game Hades blew up a couple years ago, even if it is good, I was like, see, even if there's some... The fact that they have to subvert every... It's like, no, they subverted every single character. It's like, okay, then why is it Hades then? Like, you know.
Right.
Anyway, nothing against that game, although I will say, since we were talking about this, there is a game called Never Alone, Kasima in Gituna. I'm probably not pronounce it right, but we were talking about it because it's like a co-op game that's based on Inuit mythology, and a lot of it is about using actual, like, period weapons from their culture as in a game. It's interesting. So I am glad that we're finally moving beyond the usual, like, Rome, ancient feudal Japan dichotomy, like, to more interesting.
Right.
Stuff.
Yeah. We've kind of done that a lot.
Yeah. And so. I've broken up the pitch here into little chunks, not all of it, but this part. So here's another one here. If you want to read the gameplay section here, and then I'll chime in with my commentary afterward.
We want to do a lot more than just make a funny game with Barkley 2. We want it to be fun as well. Barkley 2 maintains the same humor, tone, and fierce devotion to canon as the first game, but gives the player greater choice in the story. It is a non-linear, open-ended game that focuses on exploration, discovering secrets, and getting lost in the crazy post-cyberpocalyptic world. It combines a lot of the ideas of Eastern RPGs, like focus on narrative and characters, with Western RPGs, like making choices within the story, long-term consequences, and non-linearity. We want to do a lot of things with this game, and it's pretty safe to say that it will be very experimental. Here's a few things from the game's features. Things change over time. People's places and quests change over time. The things you experience might be completely different than what your friends experience because you did them at different times. The official big idea behind Barkley 2 is that everyone will have a different game. Things changing over time is the backbone of this idea.
I want to make it super clear, since this is an audio medium. The original Barkley was a joke game. Like, all the art was stolen from old games and crudely modified to be basketball themed. There were no branching paths or meaningful choices. It was a game for jokes, and it was like primarily a vehicle for humor. So so instead of like leaning into their strengths and making another small, light, comedy-driven game, they like flipped their chair around and sat backwards in like a cool substitute and were like, but what if we made a real game? Like, that even at the time I was reading this, I was like, uh-oh, because see, that kind of scope creeped in. Like, nobody asked for what they're trying to do. Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone. So it's Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and taking it to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley. Ooh, I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. Cause it's basketball. But Mr. Kirch's flow.
Yeah, but I know scope creep is real as someone who is currently in the midst of illustrating 500 cards by hand. I know scope creep is like a real thing, but I don't hate the idea that they're going for. Like they did that to like kind of get their teeth cut. Like, everybody's first things are just kind of like a silly thing, but this is like a real big step in an interesting direction. So, I mean, we're talking about it, so it obviously doesn't end well, but I'm still curious as to like how this goes about.
Yeah. And then here, the next part here.
Large open world. Necron 7 is a large open environment with dozens of areas to explore. There are things to find in every corner and secrets everywhere. This is a game all about exploration.
And the original Barkley was like very linear. It was like a series of hubs where you were just like in a town and then you'd like go to a dungeon and then come back. Like, this is them branching into new stuff, like we were talking about earlier.
I don't know, because the first one sounds like it was a lot like some of the really cool Flash games that I played on Newgrounds, right, back in the day. But this, they're really trying to go for like at least a single A kind of gaming experience here.
Yeah,
and this is now the next thing they say. Go ahead.
I was saying, that is also part of the context in 2012. Like, we didn't really have an indie gaming like market like we do now. Like, indie games were a thing, but crowdfunding, it just happened. So a lot of times it was just like individuals making stuff, like, you know, their passion projects, or like small teams making things. This idea of like all of a sudden, oh, this like niche type of genre that games don't get made in very much, we can make one now. This was a new thing. So a lot of people were experiencing this sort of sudden new uptick of like their thing getting made.
Right. They're saying
fast-paced action RPG combat. Barkley 2 has mouse-aimed shooting gameplay that takes inspiration from action games like Crimson Land and Soldat, but also RPGs like Dark Souls and Gothic. Stats, classes, and an incredibly deep character creation system give you complete control over your character. We want to make Barkley 2 a game that's not only funny, but fun to play.
Okay, that seems like a lot, but go off. Like, obviously creating a really deep combat system like Dark Souls and all that, that takes an enormous amount of work. But like, as far as like creating a character creation system that has like a lot of depth to it, what that is it's just a front load of a lot of art processing time. But you know, we have other like smaller developers like what is it, the Chill Ape, whoever makes Stardew Valley, right?
Concerned Ape, yeah.
So like, yeah, Concerned Ape, yeah. Kind of the opposite of a Chill Ape.
Yeah, Chill Ape sounds like an NFT.
So it's not, yeah, it's not impossible, but I can kind of see where you're getting at, that this is character creation is not the most important thing that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, and like a big part of why Barkley was such a crossover hit is because it was actually a pretty easy game. Like it was turn-based and the combat was like Paper Mario. It was like small numbers, not right. super complicated. You did like little mini games each time. It was a very like easy game to play. And this is like they're giving you math homework. It's like, okay, what if you had to like make characters and stuff and do like it's like kind of like this is how it's feeling to me is it's like you're putting up like these roadblocks between the funny stuff, which if it's a game, you know, as a good game, cool, but it's kind of just this isn't Kingdom of Loathing. People aren't always going to want to do math jokes in between their joke, their humor.
Yeah, and they also say
randomized guns system, which is guns with an apostrophe for some reason. Guns, again with an apostrophe, are randomized throughout a complex system similar to Diablo's or Borderlands, offering millions of possibilities. Shotguns that shoot ooze, machine gun rocket launchers, and gravity rifles are the tip of the iceberg for our guns system. Even more with this, you can fuse guns together in a system similar to demon fusing from the Shin Megami Tensei and Persona series. The weapon combinations are nearly unlimited.
Again, I don't dislike it. But yeah, I can see how it might be a pain in the ass to create. But again, you know, The Binding of Isaac has a lot of that same kind of thing, where like there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of different variations that could happen here.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Binding of Isaac. I'm going to bring that up a little bit later, actually, on some other games.
Yeah,
like, and this is actually kind of in the original Barkley. There is like a little mini game where you can breed basketballs, and the joke there is that it's like way more complicated than you'd expect, and they actually modeled everything. So this is them kind of taking the joke from the first game and being like, "What if we did it for real?" Which it's interesting. They've shown that they can do this. So I'm going to be talking a lot more about the randomized gun system later because you know this wound up getting out of hand. So I'll just talk more about it then. But we have this last part here.
Dwarfnet. Connect with fellow dwarves and dwarf enthusiasts in the in-game Dwarfnet message board. Jack your cranial USB into the data matrix and search for clues or chat with tech-savvy dwarves about VidCon's layups and the latest jock news through the amazing power to bio-cybernetic technology.
Okay. So, if it was a built-in like closed system where you could search like in a big sprawling message board for data, that is an interesting idea, but the one thing I know that like the thing that kills indie games is when they're like, oh, let's make it multiplayer, and it's like, oh, that's so much fucking harder to do than anyone understands, because it's not just, you don't just turn on the multiplayer button in your video game. You have to like have servers that allow for like incredibly responsive action between the characters, right? Like your ping has to be extremely low in order for it to work. And like AAA games with slightly bad servers will just like suddenly there's nobody playing because, you know, you'll pull the trigger on somebody and then like, you know, a half a second later it'll fire the gun and then the person's, you know, a mile away. So this is the one where I'm just like, all right, if you're actually trying to have some sort of online interactivity, go back to the drawing board, because that's not what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, this was right after Dark Souls, so everyone was getting really into, what if we put some kind of messaging system in our game? And even this one, if it would have been scaled down to be just like a thing in the game universe, I think as a vehicle for jokes, it's a great idea, but again, with the scale, like, we'll talk more about the Dwarfnet and what went out of control with that. But I will say one thing that stands out in the pitch that you're not going to see because we're not looking at the whole thing is that the screenshot mockups look like an actual game because they got a pixel artist to work on it named Frankie Smileshow. Frankie's the MVP of this episode. He gets done real dirty, and he was the one guy who actually did his job and did a really pretty good job with it. Like, I've included some screenshots from the Kickstarter here, but like compared to the original,
oh, yeah,
like this looks like a real game. Like this looks like something you see like Devolver selling.
Yeah, no, that's funny because I'm looking at it here and it does look like a cool like 16-bit action RPG game from the days of yore. But I do like that they have like a little status bar in the bottom right that just says status neurotypical. Which implies that there's a status that says status autistic.
That's actually kind of a reference to the first game. And the first game, like, they have, you know, in like RPGs, you have status effects like poison or sleep or whatever. And Barkley, there's stuff like they're like glaucoma, and one of them is autism, and you cure it with alcohol. I mean, not autism, Asperger's. Asperger's. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I got that wrong. Yeah, that's not nearly as nice of it. It was in the time. Asperger's jokes were very funny. Like the guy who made it. That's like in his bio screen. He's like, "Hi, I'm Chef Boyardee, the guy who made this website. For more information, please check out my website." It's the Wikipedia page for Asperger's.
Okay. See, that's different than Matt Rife telling all of his friends, like all of his detractors, to go and buy the special needs helmets. This is when it's pointed at yourself. It's different.
Yeah, and also because this is a Kickstarter fiasco, I have to include the original release date.
Okay, our current estimate,
the current estimate is late 2013 or early 2014. We've done a lot of good work so far. We've got a long way to go.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so how much do you think it raised? I'll let you guess before I scroll down.
90,000.
Good, that's pretty close. It raised a total of $120,335. Okay. From 4,636 backers, pledged from a $35,000 goal. So they thought they could do this for $35,000. And also, I put a little note, like, I know you mentioned, but if you want to do any other Kickstarter, like, insights and stuff from your own experience based off of this, now's a good time to do it.
I mean, my last Kickstarter raised $53,000 out of a goal of $8,000. And they do take a percentage out of it, and there's like a lot of other like complexity that happens with it. As anybody with familiarity with not EVE Online, what's the other one? Star Citizen. As anybody who's like even remotely familiar with all that would know, the difficult thing about so long as you're making entries into like, no, the game is coming, we are still working on it, Kickstarter, like, you're losing your ability to ever say you don't have to release the game on time, is what I'm trying to say. Because like my third edition of my Terror Deck, I added on like 4 months of development process because I read the book for it and I was like, I can write better than this, I don't want to release this as my claim. And I took, you know, a huge amount of time to sit back and rewrite the whole thing, you know, page by page, and the added time, but the final product is great, right?
Yeah.
So with this, they have the money, and once those cards are charged, unless they like catastrophically like abscond with everything, I'm pretty sure it the only thing that can get them to refund it is like if they come out and like say, yeah, it's never going to happen, you know, teehee. Or like a class action lawsuit, which is not going to happen, right?
Yeah, no, that's perfect, because we're going to talk something a bit more about that later. But yeah, you were kind of, because your thing is that, you know, you're an artist and you were doing this yourself. This is going to be interesting because we find out that this was a product of a team. One thing I want to bring up here is that while the thread presents it as if the game is something by Shoemaker and Realm, when Jason Schreier from Kotaku interviews them, it reveals that it's actually something that's being made by a team of people with. And Chef Boyardee and Shoemaker is just taking a break from college for a year to work on it. I have this quote here. There are 6 or 7 members on the team behind Barkley 2, and they've been thinking about this game for quite some time now. Shoemaker, 24, is studying computer science at Montgomery College. He took the year off from school just to make this game. If the Kickstarter doesn't get funded, they'll still make it, but they might scale back a bit, Shoemaker said. So, this kind of feels, it almost feels like they were like, why not make a Barkley 2 Kickstarter? And then it kind of went out of control and became like a big thing.
Yeah, I mean, that can happen once money starts moving around. And like, yeah, it can be a little intoxicating when you see, you know, 100 people saying how much they want you to make something. And then your mind just goes, well, if there's 100 people here, what if there's 1,000 people outside and then 10,000 people further on? And, you know, I can get how that goes, you know.
Well, this episode went a little bit long, but, so you're going to have to jam with the rest for a little bit, but you can come back next week to slam with the best here at Value from the Internet.
Oh, man. Didn't like any of that. Hi.
I didn't have the thing ready. You do it.
No, you're fine. That's so funny. We have to keep that.
This is why you handle the outro.
Yeah. No, that's funny. Yeah, so that's going to do it for us for this week, but we do have part two where we're going to go into the whole nightmare of whatever this was, or maybe it's great. I don't know. I don't know any of this stuff. So you can always find us at iftipod@gmail.com. We're on iftipod at Twitter. If you have any ideas for stories, or if you are cool and you would like to like contribute a story, or if you have your own podcast and you want to like do a crossover episode, we would love to hear from you. So shoot us a DM there or email us at any of those. You can find me on Instagram at Calculations. I'm still taking pre-orders for the card game that I'm making that is actually going to be real and good. And you can, you know, buy all the other weird bullshit I make at winslowdomain.com. And I'm also on winslowdomain at on Twitter as well. So, Jay, where can they find you?
I'm Jay Brandstetter pretty much everywhere. This show is what I've been mostly focusing my energy on right now, but so I'm glad it's back in the swing of things. And yeah, you know, I'm always happy to guest on stuff. I've been guesting on a couple of shows. Shout out to Marcos and some other people who listen. Yeah, I'm just excited to be working on this. I'm excited to conclude this one because this one goes best.
I'm From the Internet is created by Jay Brandstetter and Winslow Domain, edited by Steve Brown, music by Steve Isbrook.